Welcome to Culinary Convo. I am your host, Devin Ream. The coffee is poured and your spot at the table is open. I've got my mise en place, and if your mind is open, let us begin. All right, everybody, how's it going? This is your host, Devin Ream, and yeah, I'm going to be doing it solo today, once again, with Plate in Time. Interesting one this week. Taking a look at Liberia. So 1950s Africa is where we're leaving it off. And like I said, 1950s Africa. Really interesting just because it's one of those areas in the world that honestly you don't hear about too often. But like I said, I think that it's one of those things that we need to look into more. And my little plate and time machine is going right for it. So let's get started. 1950s Africa in Liberia, going over the history of Liberia. During World War II, thousands of indigenous Liberians migrated from the nation's rural interior to the coastal regions in search of jobs. The Liberian government had long opposed this kind of migration, but was no longer able to restrain it. In the decades after 1945, the Liberian government received hundreds of millions of dollars of unrestricted foreign investment, which destabilized the Liberian economy. Government revenue rose enormously, but was being grossly embezzled by government officials. Growing economic disparities caused increased hostility between indigenous groups and Americo-Liberians. The social tensions led President Tubman to enfranchise the indigenous Liberians either in 1951 or 1963. Accounts differ. Tubman and his Whig party continued to repress political opposition and rig elections. The first railway in Liberia was not constructed until 1945. So almost like 100 years after America had done so. Almost. From the late 19th century, European powers such as the UK and Germany invested in infrastructure in their African colonies, making them more competitive in terms of getting products to market, improving communications. But in 1926, Firestone, an American rubber company, started the world's largest rubber plantation in Liberia. This industry created 25,000 jobs, and rubber quickly became the backbone of the Liberian economy in the 1950s. Rubber accounted for 40% of the national budget. During the 1930s, Liberia signed concession agreements with Dutch, Danish, German, and Polish investors in what has been described as an open-door economic policy. And then over the 50s here, between 1946 and 1960, exports of natural resources such as iron, timber, and rubber rose significantly. And in 1971, Liberia had the world's largest rubber industry and was the third largest exporter of iron ore. Since 1948, ship registration was another important source of state revenue. After World War II, the U.S. pressured Liberia to resist the expansion of Soviet influence in Africa during the Cold War, and Liberian President William Tubman was agreeable to this policy. Between 1946 and 1960, Liberia received some $500 million in unrestricted foreign investment, mainly from the U.S. From 1962 to 1980, the U.S. donated $280 million in aid to Liberia. In the 1970s, under President Tolbert, Liberia strove for a more non-aligned and independent posture and established diplomatic relations with the Soviet Union, China, Cuba, and Eastern Bloc countries. It also severed ties with Israel during the Yom Kippur War in 1973, but announced it supported American involvement in the Vietnam War. So kind of taking a two-sided extent moving forward for your industry, but also for your country's, you know, future economic hopes. But yeah, taking a look at one of the documents that I found online, it talks about the Office of the Historian and going over diplomatic relations with the United States and Liberia. Goes over this. This was June 29th of 1950. During a courtesy call on the president today, I discussed the present role of the United States economic mission and public health mission vis-a-vis the 0.4 program as it is being proposed for Liberia. And this it says confidential subject conversation with President Truman. And like I said, this is by the ambassador to Liberia, who was Dudley at the time. And it says up here, it was Foreign Relations of the United States, 1950, the Near East, South Asia, and Africa. But he says here, moving forward, after I had expressed appreciation to the president for his remarks on the work of our economic mission in Liberia, delivered in a speech before a convention of the American Newspaper Guild yesterday, the president replied that he was sincerely interested in the development of Liberia, not only from a standpoint of our historical ties, but because of the evidenced desire of the Liberian people to help themselves to a position of democratic affluence in the world today. I mentioned the oft-repeated request of the Liberian government for assistance in transforming their local frontier force into a modern military unit capable of maintaining internal security, which in addition to maintaining order throughout the country would also serve to protect the vast American investments in Liberia. The president assured me that it was also his desire that Liberia have some military guidance on the scene, and further stated that he would discuss the matter with the Secretary of Defense. In closing, he mentioned that a small military mission in Liberia would be desirable not only for the reasons stated, but to forestall the possibility of any future development in that area similar to the Korean situation today. So in 1950, Truman is equating what's going on in Liberia to the heavy, heavy, worrisome things going on in Korea or South Korea, as it were. So interesting, not only to see the kind of, behind the veil things, of presidencies, and that always happens whenever these memorandums and records and things get disclosed, but especially for, you know, our plate in time, the future of our little countries, that we're looking at here. And then going over, UCA University, I believe, let me double check. Yeah, University of Central Arkansas, political science, going over Liberia. It was going over the Sub-Saharan Africa region, 1943 to present. It states, in the early 1950s, the government proclaimed a state of emergency in the town of Harbel as a result of labor unrest by workers at the 80,000-acre Firestone Rubber Company plantation beginning in December 1949. And so it's right on that dot. President Tubman sent troops to Harbel after riots broke out at the plantation on February 4th, 1950. So, yeah, the ambassador to Liberia talks to President, you know, Truman. They have these things going on. That was in June, granted, compared to February. But isn't it odd that, you know, these things are happening at a rubber plantation? And what do you know, in June of that year, they're like, you know, maybe we need more military presence. Oh, man. Anyway, on January 11th, 1951, the governments of Liberia and the U.S. signed an agreement to provide a U.S. military training mission in Liberia. The U.S. military training mission consisting of several U.S. military personnel arrived in Monrovia on August 27th, 1951. And President Tubman was reelected on May 1st of 1951, and he was inaugurated for the second term in January 1952. William R. Tolbert of the TWP was elected as vice president, and Americo-Liberian women and indigenous Liberians who owned property were allowed to vote for the first time in the 1951 elections. Previously, only the male descendants of Americo-Liberians had the right to vote. The Liberia government entered a mutual defense agreement with the U.S. government on November 19, 1951, and President Tubman was reelected with a 99.5% of the vote on May 3, 1951. 1955, and he was inaugurated for a third term in January 1956. Man, that number seems a little too high, but I don't want to, who knows, maybe the competitor was the other politician, which I don't have the name on here, maybe they just were really that bad, but 99.5%. Yeah, that's interesting. One of the individuals involved in an assassination plot, for President Tubman, was a former minister of the interior, Samuel David Coleman, and he was killed along with his son, Joseph S. Othello Coleman, during an arrest attempt on June 27th, 1955. Two government security personnel were also killed on June 27th, 1955. The U.S. government deployed a military assistance advisory group, or a MAG, consisting of 17 military personnel in Liberia in 1956. Yeah. And then it says here that in 1959, President Tubman was reelected with more than 99% of the vote, again, and was inaugurated for his fourth term. Yeah. And then the U.S. and Liberia signed a military defense agreement again on July 8th, 1959. So I read all of this off. Basically, you can take it one of two ways. One is that, obviously, American military power, we are heavily invested in making sure we get our money's worth, but at the same time, we want our interests defended. I think that's every country. It's not just the United States. But to go to the extent at which the United States does might be another matter. The other thing would be that the second way you can put it is that we are, yeah, very hawkish on our military. And if we have any American investment in the country, which with Firestone, it looks like that would have been a major investment. Yeah, we're gonna do what we have to protect that investment, especially during the 50s. And you notice the expansion of plastics and rubber and the car boom during that time. It all kind of falls in alignment. And so that's really how Liberia, honestly, you know, was very heavily connected to the United States at that time. And I position it towards the United States just because I'm a U.S. citizen. I'm an American. So I look at it from that angle of how are they connected to us in the 50s? Like, how did this happen? And it sounds like it was the major thing. It was 40% of essentially their GDP at the time. And that's just, yeah, it's kind of crazy to see how that connects. Through ProPublica.org, they talk about Firestone and the Warlord Chapter 2, and it's a whole series talking about warlords, not only in Liberia, but in other countries in Africa, but it mainly focuses on Liberia and some of the things that have occurred over there. And what they've got is, to the little Republic of Liberia, Firestone has brought a new day of hope and advancement, Firestone said in one broadcast. It has been gratifying, it has been a gratifying thought to us that by means of commercial progress, we have been of service to mankind. The 1950s were golden years for Firestone and Liberia's elite. Firestone was Liberia's largest private employer and the largest exporter in the country. Firestone's profits after taxes amounted to three times the government's total revenue for 1951, according to one study. There's a picture here of Harvey Firestone Jr. And giving a handshake between Liberia and the tire giant, and it is former President William Tubman. It is courtesy of the Indiana University Liberian Collections. But moving on, it says the company tightened its relationships with the country's ruling class, in part by helping them become rubber farmers, providing free saplings and agricultural advice. When the rubber began to flow, Firestone purchased it. Former Presidents Charles King, Edwin Barclay, William V.S. Tubman, and Tolbert all owned large rubber plantations, every single one of them. To preserve its plantation, Firestone worked closely with whoever ran Liberia, no matter how they came to power or what they did to hold on to it. And in office for nearly 30 years, Tubman turned into a virtual dictator, squashing dissent, imprisoning political opponents, and creating a spy network to track ordinary citizens. Firestone maintained such close ties with him that when the daughter of one plantation executive got married, she and her husband honeymooned at Tubman's summer retreat outside Monrovia. Yeah. That's how connected they were. And with the, you know, I would say in the 1950s, the heavy talk of everybody in Liberia was mainly the plantations, what was going on with Firestone, and the political things going on as well. And then you have these military joinments, right, between the two countries. And yeah, you kind of have this recipe of private industry mingling with the government in heavy ways. And, you know, depends on your view of things, but usually that's kind of when things get messy. But what it does have here, coming from the NY Times and moving more towards the food side of things and moving away from the, you know, the political kind of bad stuff. We're going towards their food in Liberia, because Liberia is quite the lively country. Liberian-American Thanksgiving for West Africa, and this was in the NY Times, New York Times, in November of 2021. And it says, in Liberia, Thanksgiving, celebrated on the first Thursday of November, is simply a day off from work for some. Others observe it as a religious occasion with fasting and prayer, and in the 1950s, a time of greater economic prosperity, food and showy consumption became a bigger part of celebrations, including Thanksgiving, said C. Patrick Burroughs, an expert on Liberian history and the former vice president of academic affairs at Cuttington University in Liberia. Liberia was founded in 1822 for the resettlement of freed American slaves. Its name comes from the Latin word that means free. The capital city of Monrovia is named after the U.S. president, James Monroe. So technically you could say Monrovia. And who established the Republic of Liberia. Much of the culture and foods from Liberia are adapted from African-American culture. This can be seen in the American currency that is often used to purchase groceries and in the American English language that is spoken on the streets of Monrovia. So yeah, they're using U.S. dollar bills to essentially, you know, go through economic activity, and they speak American English in Liberia, especially in the capital city of Monrovia. But yeah, kind of interesting. And that was foodbycountry.com, Kazakhstan to South Africa, going over that 1822 resettlement and that history. But then the NY Times going over Thanksgiving becoming a huge thing in the 50s in Liberia. I'm guessing that had probably something to do with some of the American, they say Americo-Liberia, or Liberian. I'm guessing that is kind of the connection there. You start to interact with those. And in America, especially in the 1950s, I would guess 4th of July, Thanksgiving, Christmas, probably a big deal. And especially if you're not in your home country, you're going to do what you can to make it something, you know, better. But they had the day off as well. So anything to get away from work. That's what we usually I notice. And that's American, Canadian, Japanese, Korean. If you can find a way of like, this is a holiday now, I think everybody's happy with it. It's fine. So anyway, going on here to jstor.org. Basically, it's the Rethinking the History of Settler Agriculture in 19th Century Liberia. And JSTOR, or JSTOR, basically is the It is a part of the Ithaca, a nonprofit organization helping the academic community use digital technology to preserve the scholarly record. But yeah, it is a journal storage, basically, of different academic journals. And this one going over the 19th century Liberia. It's by William E. Allen. It says here, taking a look, it goes over in 1870, five Americo-Liberians as descendants of the free American slaves who founded Liberia in 1822 later called themselves, sat down to lunch. Their host, another Americo-Liberian, served the midday meal, and an account of the occasion was subsequently published in a local paper. An excerpt from the story follows. We had scarcely finished friendly greetings when another little stir arrested our attention, and lo, a fine Liberian dumb boy, the name of which is associated with so many reminiscences. The dumb boy, notwithstanding its singular name, is a very excellent dish. We Liberians would not exchange for any foreign dishes that could be offered. It is healthy, harmless, and very nutritious. Anecdotes like this narrative about the dumb boy and recently uncovered archival evidence suggest that scholars must reconsider a fundamental assumption, and that assumption mainly being that we weren't, you know, going through a lot of these things agriculturally before we showed up, basically before American colonization began. It talks about here the dumb boy, or more appropriately, door boy, is derived from the Bassa language of Liberia. Door, D-O-R, meaning cassava, and boy, or mortar. So together, door boy denotes cooked cassava that is prepared by pounding into a mortar. Door boy is eaten by dousing the pounded dough. Yeah, so it's... It goes through that, but basically it talks about, you know, African cuisine there. And yeah, they were doing a lot of these things well before our colonization or things were happening in that time. And it talks about, it says, who founded Liberia in 1822, later called themselves. So it's interesting to see that that is mainly what is documented throughout that entire time. But yeah, kind of cool. I know that the main thing with the door boy and fufu and a lot of those, you're grabbing a tuber of some kind or a starch of some kind, and you're basically making, it's not a paste, but it's basically this, you know, dough that then you can use to eat with other soups, stews, meats, and other things. And you use that in a lot of everyday cooking, which, you know, and I think for like more what you would consider European American taste, bread. That's, I mean, you know, bread, or even if you want to go, you know, 1950s and on, corn in the United States. We use corn in so many things, and flour. And so we use it for tortillas, bread, flat breads, whatever it may be. Rolls, right? Parker House or farmhouse rolls and all those things. And so, you know, you're just grabbing something that's starchy and making it a good delivery system for the rest of the foods because you want it to be more filling. And yeah, it goes all the way back to then. Then going over BBC.com's World Africa, it talks about in May 1951, women and indigenous property owners vote in the presidential election for the first time. And 1958, racial discrimination was outlawed. Yeah, in Liberia, racial discrimination was outlawed. And I've got a feeling that some of the American strife and that probably transferred over. I can't imagine that it wouldn't connect in some way. But yeah, it's interesting to see that compared to the entire civil rights struggle that occurred all the way through the 60s. And yeah, it's one of those things where it makes you kind of understand where the rest of the world, including those connected with America at the time, were sitting. So pretty interesting. And so going over, it's technically called L'Academie.com, L'Academie.com. It's going over Liberian foods. And it's talking about traditional Liberian foods. And they have four starchy Liberian foods you have to try. And granted, all of this is, it says that can make your eyes twinkle 2022, which, you know, sure, but they're all traditional Liberian dishes, which is mainly what I'm going for in the 1950s through our plate in time. You got fufu, or boiled yam, cassava, and green plantain. Then you've got, the first time you see a white fufu block, you will not think that this food has a rich history. Thus, don't be fooled by its pretty monotonous look. Fufu was born in Ghana, and you can find it under other names, fufu, or fufuo, fufu, or fofo. However, the dish isn't limited to only one area. You can order it in restaurants in West Africa, Liberia, Nigeria, and more. This jewel of traditional Liberian recipes requires boiled cassava and green plantain or cocoa yam to be mashed into a dough and fermented. This process will make the dough a bit of a sour taste, so like a sourdough type of recipe. Fufu allegedly appeared when the Portuguese traders brought cassana to Ghana in the 16th century. I'm guessing they're trying to say cassava. To have a fulfilling meal, you should pair fufu with broth-like soup. You should wash your hands carefully before eating it, as the locals believe that enjoying fufu with bare hands is 10 times more delicious than scooping it up. If you don't believe me, let's check my words. You can learn how to prepare the Liberian staple dish fufu and soup from this guide. And then pounded yam. So very close to the fufu. You can easily mistake pounded yam with fufu. Actually, pounded yam is a type of boiled and non-fermented fufu. Normal fufu experiences a fermenting process and has a sour taste, while pounded yam doesn't. So it's more like your white bread, right? Then you have jollof rice, or spicy rice. For Africans, rice isn't just food. It conveys a deep history as well. To enjoy this specialty, I have a suggestion for you. During your Liberian trip, jollof rice. Its birthplace is the 14th century Senegambia region in West Africa. At this time, this country was ruled by the Jollof Empire. When the Jollof people immigrated to several parts of West Africa, they also brought their rice dish along. Different nations have their own jollof rice variations. Some of the most famous versions are from Liberia, Ghana, Sierra Leone, and Nigeria. For me, the Liberian version always wins my heart. This dish is usually prepared from long grain rice to have a fluffy texture, and you can serve this rice with fish to create a perfect Liberian rice combo full of nutrients. Yeah. And then dumboy, as we mentioned earlier, it's the national dish in Liberia. And its appearance is quite similar to fufu or pounded yam. Cassava is the main crop here, so it is easy to understand why the locals process various dishes with this veggie. Unlike other starchy dishes that can combine with any broth-like soups or stews, I recommend you drizzle pepper soup in dumboy to enjoy the heavenly taste. This is the much-loved specialty of several ethnic groups, including Bassa, Mono, and Gio. What's more fantastic than tasting a plate of this Liberian food for dinner on a windy day? You should appreciate it, as the cooks spend much time preparing dumboy by pounding boiled cassava with a mortar and pestle cautiously before placing it on the table. And then those savory soups and stews that you're wanting with your dumboy or your fufu, huh? You got okra soup, or okra soup. Do you know that okra is considered as ladies' fingers? That is a fancy name, right? That's what they say in here. Around 2000 BCE, okra was grown commonly in Western Africa and other continents thanks to the Bantu migrations. People used okra to cook a steaming soup and serve it with rice. Besides the core vegetable, Liberians also complement protein and flavor by adding shrimp, fish, goat meat, and African spices. An interesting story relating to okra is that soldiers purchased okra seeds as fake coffee from enslaved African Americans during the American Civil War. After being dried under the sunlight, these dried seeds have a similar appearance to coffee. Yeah. And then palava, or smoked meat or fish in a spicy soup. When you travel to West Africa, you can catch different versions of palava, but pay attention to the Liberian one. You will be impressed with this combination of spinach and molokia leaves, since this is the only country that uses this mixture. Although palava is eaten widely in African countries, its name originated from a Portuguese word meaning lengthy debate. The exact origin of this name is unclear, but its colorful appearance and deliciousness are beyond dispute. I'm guessing that's a joke by the writer here, which, by the way, the writer of this article on this website, it is Jamie. And it says he's a food enthusiast who loves cooking at L'Académie. You will learn simple cooking tips, nutrition advice, as well as approach tasty recipes that you can make in less than 30 minutes. And so, but anyway, going over the rest of these soups and stews, you have Liberian GB soup or Gibi soup, and it's like a meat gravy. When you enter a local restaurant and see GB on the menu, GB stands for GB, a long-established cassava-based dish in Liberia. It is a favorite thick gravy dish of many local tribes. This dish is usually eaten at big celebrations such as weddings. It is not vegan food, so vegetarians should consider it carefully before requesting it. Its mild taste and creamy texture are the factors holding you on at a party. The African spices will add a little bit of desert breath to the dish, and the citizens often serve it with rice or fufu to have a satisfying meal. And then the next one here, which is the main one that I've heard of before, Liberian chicken gravy. I bet you cannot find a stew that is richer than Liberian chicken gravy. Why? It consists of many nutritious ingredients: chicken, fish, shrimp, and African spices. The texture of this food tends to be gravy-like as the Liberians cook it until the water is gone. Moreover, they also create a twist for the food by grinding green and red bell pepper coarsely to awaken your taste buds. As meat is quite pricey for most Liberian families, this chicken dish is often served on special occasions. And then you have mafé, or Liberian peanut stew. Peanut stew or ground nut stew is a familiar dish of Western African countries, including Liberians. Depending on the region, you can find it under various names, especially Domada in Gambia or Tiga de Ghana in Senegal. Apparently, the Bambara and Mandinka people living in Mali invented peanut stew. It is quite challenging to find a common recipe for all areas, but usually contains chicken, peanuts, onions, and African spices. And then there's Liberian cabbage stew, which, looking at the picture here, it's got shrimps on top, but it looks like a ton of cabbage, like a lot of cabbage. Cabbage is one of the most popular types of leafy vegetables in Liberia. Thus, you have to be introduced to the well-known traditional dish made from it. The veggie isn't the only thing that makes this stew tick. Locals always include fried chicken in the recipe. Besides, its flavor will be elevated with the appearance of beef, tomato paste, onions, and more. And if you need a quick Liberian dish to fill in your stomach for lunch, you can choose this stew in any starchy food you want. The waiters will bring you a soup pot with tender meat and thick sauce. Watch out for your mouth. It is watering after the Liberian trip. Don't forget to tell your friends how wonderful cabbage stew is. And then there's Torborji soup, which, if you enter a local Liberian restaurant, you don't know what soup you should order, let's follow my recommendation, Torborji soup. Its flavor is quite special, since you will experience an exotically bitter and spicy taste. The heart and soul of this recipe is earthy-tasting red cow peas, or in some cases, lentils. Other additional ingredients, including dried meat, fish, and palm oil, they all play their role in improving the texture and flavor of the dish. The Liberians love Taborji, yet it especially seduces the Lorma people living in Lofa country, northern Liberia. When you wonder about side dishes to go with it, don't hesitate to ask fellow diners about how to enjoy Taborji properly. And then there's Liberian potato greens. That's right. It is sweet potato leaves. Yeah. Besides this veggie, the chefs also cook meat to add protein to your meal. And so they serve it with rice, the sauce with rice, to help you feel full longer. Although fresh potato leaves are quite common, people can dry them to prolong their shelf life. Fresh leaves can be cooked directly while the cooks soak the dried ones for about 2 hours. And then there's Liberian kala, or deep-fried dumplings. And these look amazing. And it kind of reminds me of hush puppies, but I don't know if there's cornmeal. It says kala is the name that Liberians call puff puff. This is a favorite snack of many students. In Liberia, many pepper kala vendors are women. A few run a small stall on the streets to support their families. Besides this regular version, the chefs here can transform it into a Liberian sweet treat. After deep frying in vegetable oil, these golden balls can be tossed in sugar to create a white snowy layer on the outside. You can enjoy it on its own or with coffee and beans and beverages for breakfast. The Liberian dish for an early morning meal will make you feel like an authentic Liberian. The main ingredient is simple, consisting of flour, sugar, salt, water, yeast, and sometimes egg. So like I said, no cornmeal. but it does. It looks like hush puppies a little bit. And then there is fried eggplant. Eggplant is a favorite veggie of many people, and Liberians are not an exception. They have fallen in love with it and turned it into a savory dish to serve with rice. And then you can explore more on lacademy.com. It was a great site going over these, and especially including the dumboy or duboy. Or door boy, I should say. But yeah, that would be our plate in time, guys. It is a short but sweet one. Kind of hints why I'm kind of doing it on my own today. But still very rich in its history here, with the connection to the U.S., not only by its history, but by its economic activity. And also the foods during that time, I'm sure, probably comforted many, whether it was for the strikes or the riots they had mentioned, the change over time, and it's become a cultural touchstone. And they talk about how the food, it's emblematic of like African-American cuisine. It's hard to tell now after I've watched like High on the Hog and those kinds of things. I think you got to give Liberia and Africa way more credit. you know, it's one of those things. It is just purely African cuisine. African-American cuisine definitely probably came back into the 1950s, which is just including more Americanized ingredients, I'm sure. But yeah, it's very interesting to see how these things have grown over time. And if you grew up in the Midwest like I did, or the South, you know how important fried okra or any type of okra is. And it's a love or a hate. Most people don't like the texture, or they don't like something about it. I'm not sure. I love, I think it's air fried okra. And it's like really, really crunchy type. Oh, so good. Even with the seeds. And I love the slimy texture of okra. I like fried okra. I can't get enough of it. But yeah, that would be your plate in time for 1950s Africa, is probably some chicken and gravy with some fufu, get you some okra stew, some other things going. That way you can get your door boy or dumb boy or your fufu, get your cassava, pound it with the pestle and get it ready, have your plate, and just sit around and enjoy. I really actually liked researching this episode because of all of the connections overall, along with the food. And so yeah, I hope you guys enjoyed it as well. What I'm gonna do now, I'm going to try to figure out where we're going next time for A Plate in Time. So yeah, going over Plate in Time next time. I actually am changing up Plate in Time. I actually got a couple suggestions in the old email inbox, as well as talking to some of the buddies of the pod, including Joel. Basically, these Plate in Times, what keeps happening is, unless it is heavily documented with like travels and lots of trade between certain countries and what have you, yeah, it's kind of going over the traditional meals and things of that country, which is what I already do. I do it for Mapping the Culinary World. I already do that. And so I don't want to do too many of these countries, you know, especially the 1950s Liberia. You know, we mainly went over the political things and some of the connections to the U.S. during that time. And the 50s were heavily influential everywhere, it sounds like. But the main thing is it's cool to go over that history, but in actuality, this is a plate in time, not a country in time, right? And so I actually just want to go over individual dishes and the history of them and how they came to be. And so that is what Plate in Time is now going to go towards. I think it's going to be a little more interesting. And we're still doing a random generator, so those of you kind of like Joel, who like the whole gambling bit of this, you're still going to get a random year that is going to predict essentially the year a dish or food or product was created, and it is going to be throughout the entire world still. But yeah, we're going to go over that, because like I said, doing it the way that we have been, you know, I do Mapping the Culinary World, and I don't want to do too many countries, and then I'm just talking about those same foods again. So, here we go with the random year generator. I've got 1800 to 2020. That's right. As recent as now. So let's do the 1 year here. Right now, if I had to guess, it's probably going to do something in the 30s, which is interesting. Anyway, let's see. Whoa. Okay. So 1863. So I'm doing a dish from 1863. I have to research this really in depth. I've got a couple things that I can look up, but wow. Gonna be interesting. I might even do something from the Civil War. North versus South. Pew, pew, pew. Anyway, I really appreciate all you guys listening, especially me doing it by myself. This Thursday, we've got another episode for you coming for Willamette Valley Spotlight. I hope you guys are always enjoying that. And like I said, I appreciate you joining us for A Plate in Time in 1950s Liberia. And now with the new change, gonna find a plate in time of 1863. See everybody next time.
This episode of Culinary Convo was written, produced, edited, and created by yours truly, Devin Ream, as a part of Mouthful Productions. Please check us out on Twitter, Instagram, Facebook at Culinary Convo, and our website, culinaryconvo.com, for recipes, episodes, resources, and send an email to culinaryconvopod@gmail.com with your fan suggestions or recipe submissions. You can also support the podcast by going to anchor.fm/culinaryconvo1/support so we can purchase cooking or audio equipment to help create a better podcast, or by using the funds to help further the exploration of Culinary Convo by ordering subscription boxes, food kits, or ordering food products to review. So shout out to our first supporter, Convonaut Dylan. Thank you. I also want to give audio credit to Soundtrap for our intro, transition, and outro music. Thank you.